Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. This is Vice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You tell me.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in science. Now, tonight's show is pretty much a language class. It's a class in body language that will reveal some very surprising ways we use teeny bits of behavior and mannerisms to correctly predict others' intentions and actions. We'll also talk about some areas that research finds we are not so good in making predictions. Sorry, but if a person scratches her nose, grab first for the explanation that her nose itches and not that she's lying while inventing an alibi. My guest tonight is psychologist Dr. Matthew Hertenstein, and he has done a research-driven exploration of all of our little tells in his book, The Tell, the little clues that reveal big truths about who we are. Stick with us to become a more sophisticated reader of others' nonverbal skills and maybe even learn how to rejigger your own so you send a more desirable message the next time you have a date, a job interview, or perhaps a bail hearing. Hi, Matt. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So your book is called The Tell. This is a term from poker. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, yeah, exactly. The idea of a tell in poker is that the players in poker give away little signals, whether it's through their breathing pattern, through their eye gaze, through their voice inflection, or whatever it might be. They give these little tells, these signals, that give away something about their hand, and the opponent can pick up on these and use these to his or her advantage. So that's where the name of the book comes from, although obviously the name or the, you know, the content of the book is not about poker. It's about our everyday interactions that we have with people.
And now there are a number of recent books that highlight our mind's fallibility, and you can see this, and I've had many of these authors on, these researchers on, Christopher Chabris a couple weeks ago, about how we are led astray by our intuitions. But your book is different. It focuses on where we succeed, or at least where we're capable of succeeding in seeing these little behavioral tells. And I love how you quote Sherlock Holmes, "I've trained myself to notice what I see."
Yeah, so there's, I mean, the last 5 to 10 years with great books written by people like Dan Ariely, Dan Gilbert, Daniel Kahneman, several others, great books. And it's, you know, Freakonomics is another one, obviously, where authors rightly point out our biases and our fallibilities of our mind. And that's interesting reading. It's very fascinating, you know, based on hard science and whatnot. But, you know, there's another side to the coin. And part of the reason I wanted to write this book, not the entire reason, part of the reason I wanted to write this book is to kind of give the other side of the coin and try to popularize some of this research that's been going on in the last couple decades. So that was part of the goal anyways.
And we'll do that tonight. And I want to tell people, I love throughout your book, you are really good about talking about what the caveats are. And when I first got your book, the first thing I did was open chapter 7 on detecting deception, because people believe all this stuff. Like I said in the opening, oh, if you scratch your nose or you shift in your seat, this means you're lying. And those things that we all believe, so many of us believe, mean that we're lying, really don't. But we'll get to that. I wanted to talk about the story you opened the book with, this Army sergeant at an Iraqi air base. So can you tell us that story and what happened?
Yeah, so a soldier was in Iraq who I interviewed, and he'd been, I think it was a five-hour trek, and he was going to a city, El Qaim, to drop off, you know, materials for the other soldiers. And so he was toward the front of the caravan, and he was driving along, dropped off the goods along with the caravan, and on his way out of town, he saw a vehicle on the side of the road, a police, I think. And he saw it, and he looked inside when he was going by, and he locked eyes with the driver in the car. And he just knew something wasn't right. It didn't feel right. It didn't look right. And he noticed the guy's, jaws were clenched, and he had what he told me is a quote, "Oh shit" look face on him. And, you know, he picked up on that. And so he told his supervisor that this didn't seem right. Of course, that he suspected it was a roadside bomb. And a few minutes later, of course, over the radio, he heard the explosion, and soldiers were maimed, and unfortunately, the soldiers' warning was never heeded by the supervisor. And basically, I opened the book up with the story that, you know, here he is. He made a prediction based on these nonverbal cues, what I call tells in the book. And obviously, we will never probably have to make such a prediction based on tells that with such importance, or at least hopefully not, right? But every day, nonetheless, we do make predictions about people, despite what our parents told us or might have told us never to judge a book by its cover. We do it anyways, and for good or ill.
And it turns out often we can and often we can't. And you talk about how, I mean, the difference between all these other means that people use, palm reading and tea leaf reading and everything, where, quote unquote, clairvoyance on the street corner, that science tests the predictions that people make. And so this is why it's so important that your book is research-based, and where you look at these biases, for example, like the bias where we think we know what makes us happy, and you talk about how people predict that having children will be a source of happiness, but actually the data show otherwise. And another one thing you talk about is the planning fallacy. We've talked about that, about how we are terrible at predicting the time it takes to accomplish something. So talk about where we go astray, some of these places we go astray.
In terms of our predictions?
Well, like economics. Like Cramer, you give this great example of Jim Cramer, who is supposed to be a stock expert.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, all over our minds go astray. We make these biases. We are afraid of losing money more than we are about gaining money. We think, you know, we listen to the Sunday talk shows listen to the political pundits, and you know, we assume that they know something, that they're able to predict something. And yet, when studies show the vast majority of them are miserable failures, basically. You might as well flip a coin. Another area which has huge consequences for anybody who likes to have money and a little bit more money by investing it, we pay money managers, right, to invest our money. But Burton Malkiel years ago and others have shown us that, you know, you might as well have a monkey throw a dart at a dartboard to choose a stock to invest in, because basically money managers that are paid big, big money to do this, have fancy educations, the credentials, we pay them in our mutual funds to invest our money, but they're no better than the stock averages. And if they are better, of course, there's regression to the mean, right? So the ones that may be hot-handed, you know, for a year or two in a row, there's regression to the mean, and they actually end up going lower than average, less than average, compared to the stock averages later on. So the bottom line is we like to think that we're good at some things, and people are very confident, but confidence, unfortunately, does not map onto accuracy most of the time.
Yeah, and you advise us over and over that we need to maintain humility. And another thing you advise is that to avoid forecasting the future on a single case basis. And that stock example where somebody has one score is a great example, because we think that they're a genius and maybe they were just lucky.
Yeah, exactly. And then what happens, of course, is there's the follow the herd mentality, right? And that you definitely do see that in the mutual fund industry, where, you know, a mutual fund might, you know, the top, might be in the top 5 percentage money makers versus a stock average. But then the next year, usually they're not on that list because there's regression to the mean. But in the meantime, millions and millions of dollars went into that money manager's fund, which gets him or her rich. And I'm not against anybody getting rich, of course, but more power to them. But the bottom line is that we follow that leader, that hot-handed person, when we think they had the power of prediction, but we tend to give people a little bit too much credit oftentimes.
And we'll get into the various ways that people predict, but I just want to say for anyone who's just tuned in, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking tonight with psychologist Dr. Matthew Hertenstein, and his book is The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are. Now, you talk about the birth of your son and how he develops unusually in a number of ways. So tell us a little bit about that and where that led you.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually, obviously I've done research in this area, but that was one of the catalysts for writing the book, just in general, which was, you know, I had a son and, I say in the book that, there have been about 108 billion births on Earth in history, and never did I really understand the magic of the occasion until I had my own son. And so I had my son, and it made me think, as a developmental psychologist, you know, what will he be like? What will he become as an adult? And so that obviously is a case of prediction right there, right, where we're looking at child development, early life, and trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen later on. But specifically to get to your question, within that first year, he started showing some behavioral tells, some red flags that I talk about in my book, The Tell, for autism, actually. So basically he was, you know, not making nearly as much eye contact with us as most babies do. He was kind of doing a little bit of rocking back and forth. His motor development was very delayed in some areas. He wasn't babbling. So there were a number of behaviors that I saw that just didn't seem right on the normal timetable of development. And I got my PhD studying babies, so I know something about them. And of course, everybody knows, all my friends and even my friends who are physicians and stuff know that I study babies, and so they thought I was being a little paranoid, which, you know, is always a possibility, of course. But it turns out we took them to some experts, and they actually saw some of the same red flags that I did. And so because of that, I dug even deeper than I had already been in the literature, and I found out that, you know, these signs are predictive of autism. And, in fact, there are some scientifically based behavioral therapies that people can use to help treat autism very early in life. And so there's even some preliminary evidence that you can even kind of change the track that the train is on so that perhaps the autism would never even become full-blown. So that's kind of something that's starting early on.
I was going to say, people advise you to wait and see, but this is sort of important. So you had quoted Sherlock Holmes. I read that quote earlier. I've trained myself to notice what I see. And so, you know, this, and you're right that the degree that experience can shape the brain decreases with age. So you did this aggressive early intervention with your son, and he's now a healthy boy who shows no symptoms of autism. And now we don't know, did he have these symptoms? Were these early signs? But you say that you felt it was better to provide this potentially life-altering intervention as early as possible rather than wait and see whether he was diagnosed. And really doing this thing, the Sherlock Holmes thing, I've trained myself to notice what I see, that helped you do that.
Yeah, I mean, it had real-world implications for me. And, you know, I say in the book, you know, as a scientist, I know for a fact that a case study can never tell you much of anything in terms of causality or inferring causality. So I don't know for sure if what we did made a difference for rewiring his brain, and I don't know how he would have turned out had we not given him some of these therapies, obviously. But I do think it's suggestive, and I do think it's in line with the empirical evidence that's much more systematic than the case studies. But, you know, just to get on my soapbox a little bit, and it might be a little controversial, but, you know, the behavioral therapies that are out there are scientifically based, and we know that some of them are very, very effective. And you can contrast that with some other therapies that people give a lot of attention to in the autism community. And some of it may be warranted, but in some cases, there's not much, at least, behavior or scientific evidence to back them up. So,
what is the stuff that you're talking about that's not evidence based? I don't have children, so I don't really pay attention to that, I don't think.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into this too much because I think
okay.
It you know treads in some things that I don't claim to be a complete expert on because
okay.
I'm an expert more in the behavioral stuff, but I think some of the dieting stuff that people
yeah.
do isn't always there, you know, the hardcore evidence as much as there is for the behavioral evidence. But
I know I've read that stuff. I just wasn't quite sure what you meant. But I've become very interested in epigenetics, which is how genes are affected by the environment. And there is really good evidence for that, the kind of behavioral therapy you're talking about, because there is a lot of stuff. People now talk about rewiring the brain all the time, and there's a lot of overblown stuff on that. But your book is solid on this, and you quote a psychologist, heredity deals the cards, environment plays a hand. You're not overblowing this stuff, but it's true that you can use environment and this sort of behavioral training to maybe rejigger what the genes you have, how they would manifest themselves.
Exactly. And the key to all of this, and I talk about this in the book, is catching this stuff early. So waiting until they're 3 or 4 years old to diagnose it is still better than waiting until they're 5 or 6, but it's not as good as if they're until you're, you know, starting the stuff before they're even their first birthday. So, and in fact, was about 2 weeks ago, maybe even only a week ago, some researchers published a study in, I believe, in Nature, that found that kids who develop autism, actually, they look back and they started seeing that they're not making eye contact with people to the same degree as typically developing kids, even as early as 2 months old. So the science is it's rolling out on a month-by-month basis almost, showing that they're finding out these tells for autism earlier and earlier and even more powerful. And, of course, some of this work has to be, you know, replicated and all this sort of stuff. But there's it's very, very promising. I'm really excited for the future, especially in this area.
Yeah, it's very important. Now, I want to get on to how we size up others. And you talk about our first impressions. And, you know, and there is this study of, you know, for centuries, how physical appearance relates to character. And it has a very checkered history. And so tell us about this and how it relates to what the science says. What does science say about our physical appearance and our character?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, and what I said in the book, too, is it does have a checkered history, this idea that we can look at people and make some sort of accurate impressions. And I want to make sure we understand, too, that just conceptually there's a really important difference, which is, you know, you and I might look at somebody and we might think that they look, I don't know, trustworthy, say. And so that means what scientists call that we have consensus. We both agree on that. And that's one level, and that's important. But what I'm even more interested in is the consensus accurate? So is that person really trustworthy, or do we just both think he's trustworthy and we both agree on it? And so, you know, people have mixed that up, that consensus versus, you know, accuracy over the years. And that's been somewhat problematic. But even as early, going back in history, I tell a story which I enjoyed researching about Charles Darwin. And he was, you know, of course, on the HMS Beagle, but he almost didn't go on HMS Beagle because, you know, the people who were interested or could choose whether he went on the Beagle or not thought that just by, I think it was his nose or some feature of his face,
yeah.
that he
Let
looked like
that.
too. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I quote this. The captain of the Beagle nearly passed over Darwin for the naturalist position on the Beagle because he thought the young man's nose pretended sluggishness like that of a sloth that spends its days lounging in the treetops. I mean, it's so amazing that Darwin almost didn't make it on the Beagle because he had the wrong nose. And this is the stuff that's been going on erroneously for centuries and that people still believe. And some of it's actually true, and you write about that, and we'll get into that, but that's just so amazing.
Yeah, I know. I'm a big Darwin fan. In fact, in January, I get to go to his townhouse in London for the first time. I'm pretty excited about that.
Cool.
But anyway, yeah. But anyways, yeah. I mean, so people have, you know, made these erroneous ideas, and obviously in the case of Darwin, it's very erroneous because I would think nobody would call him sluggish. and that he didn't, you know, contribute to science, obviously. But there is evidence, though, that we can show, you know, photographs or just after meeting people for just a 30 seconds to a minute or letting people watch a video, that there are some features of people's personalities or traits that do map on to what everybody else thinks about them, you know, their friends, their family members and whatnot. So, for example, there was one study done, I believe it was at the University of Texas, and they showed photos of individuals, both in sort of a, what they call a standardized photo, where they had them just kind of look into the camera, no facial expressions, just looking. And then they had a what they call a spontaneous photo, and where they could pose any way they wanted to, with any kind of expression or whatnot. And they found that
I just wanted to add that one was their whole body. So they could just, you know, you saw more than their face, and then you did in the other one. It was sort of like an expressionless passport photo in the spontaneous photo.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Thanks for adding that. And no problem. And so in both photos, they found that extroversion could be pretty well predicted. So if they showed these photos, both the standardized and the spontaneous photos, to people who didn't even know the targets in the photo, the judges, so to speak, could accurately assess how extroverted they were. You know, were they the life of the party or were they the wallflowers type people? And it mapped on to both, you know, the targets in the pictures, perceptions of themselves. Plus, they also asked about these people's personalities from their friends too. So it wasn't just them. So
yeah.
Extroversion.
I just wanted to add that was important.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. Your book, The Talent, is filled with good research. Is very, very important. This wasn't just the students said, "Oh, I'm hot and I'm extroverted," but that the researchers had both the students and people they knew assess their personalities. So it was a much more balanced study than the usual self-reported study. So anyway,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually why I featured that study in the book, is because it really was well done. It was rigorous. You know, it wasn't just a, you know, one-shot study sort of thing with only the people's self-reports. So the standardized photos and the spontaneous photos showed extroversion, but also self-esteem. Both of them, you could predict self-esteem from those, as well as, to some degree, religiosity, meaning, you know, how religious the people were from them. But this, of course, as you might guess, the spontaneous photos, you know, the photos where the people getting their picture taken could pose any way they wanted to, show their whole body and all this sort of stuff, were somewhat more revealing. So you could tell how open these people were to new experiences, how likable they were, and that sort of thing too. So there was more revealing information in the spontaneous photos than, you know, the standardized photos. But the point that I think people can take away from this is, you know, just think about all the photos that we have of ourselves on our Facebook pages, on our professional pages that we have up for work and whatnot. And not only are people going to draw conclusions from that automatically, people, we do judge a book by their cover, even though we're not supposed to, but in some cases they are accurate and reveal something about ourselves.
And I like how you say that the implication of the study, I mean, we all know, you know, if you want to look confident, sort of look, you know, pose like a confident person. But actually, I think that the way you highlight this, that we can systematically manipulate our appearance in photos in accordance with how we want others to perceive us, is important because, for example, you say if you want to send a signal that you're conscientious and outgoing with high self-esteem, you should post photos of yourself in which you're smiling, standing in a relaxed, energetic stance, and looking healthy, stylish, and neat. I like that. But, you know, while it seems maybe obvious, I think it really helps to be reminded to tell people, go look at your photos, and do they really say the thing that you are trying to say about yourself?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, a lot of this is just consciousness raising, and some people don't give it a second thought. But, in fact, you know, I would argue that it – at least for some people in some situations, it does make it a difference. I mean, just think about it. If you're in sales, for example, or something like that, I'm not a salesperson per se, but I would guess if I were a salesperson, I'd want to make sure that I'm sending the right signals, sending the right message to people. that seems important.
Yeah, and actually, if you are a salesperson, you said that people were able to predict who are the good salespeople. You might want to actually videotape yourself if you can do any sort of study without it being, swayed, that you would have people assess maybe strangers what kind of salesperson you are to see if you'd go into another career instead. Maybe that's sort of a wacky idea, but you know, if you're doing that for a living, you sort of want to know you're good at it, and maybe the dollars tell you, but that seems like something like to do your own studies based on these things to see if your photograph makes you look confident or not. And you say also that we only need to view a photograph for 50 milliseconds to detect how extroverted a person is, which is the personality trait most people that's most accurately assessed. So, you know, I mean, it's not like they're going to study your photograph and think big thoughts about it. They're going to really make a snap decision, people who look at it.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be, and oftentimes, very unconscious, right? So they're not even going to realize it. And going back to the salesperson comment and what you said, you know, videotaping yourself, I talked about toward the end of the book, I talked about a study where people actually videotaped people in sales while they're being interviewed, and they showed the subjects and had the subjects rate them on a number of different variables. And it turns out that the salespeople that, you know, were enthusiastic, empathic, supportive looking and whatnot were significantly better assessed as or had better records as salespeople as recorded by their bosses. So, you know, if I were a manager, I would definitely want to hire, you know, somebody and do a systematic study, because you can predict how well somebody's going to do at sales pretty straightforward by using these tells in a very short period of time. I think that would save people a lot of money, or companies a lot of money, from hiring the people that aren't cut out for it.
Yeah, I think that's very important. And people don't really think about this stuff, but that you really can do that. And when we get back, we're going to talk about aggression, how we predict it, or one way to predict it, which is just fascinating. But this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking tonight with psychologist Dr. Matthew Hertenstein, and his book is The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are. So it seems we're capable of predicting aggression, and there's this fascinating finding you write about in your book that aggression seems to correlate in a man to how wide his face is. And this sounds like some of that crazy stuff, but it's not. It's actually, there's good research on this.
Yeah, so it's actually a really, really consistent finding that what scientists do, the general idea is that they'll photograph subjects' faces. And they do something that's pretty straightforward, which is calculate the ratio of the width of their face to the height of their face, right? So you just measure how wide it is to how tall it is. And they've got, you know, all of this marked down to specific anatomical features on the face. And then what they do is they can take those ratios and see if they map onto subject's performance sort of well-validated experimental tests of aggression and cheating and lying and all that sort of stuff in the lab. And they find two things. Number one, the ratios do map on to all of those things I just listed, aggression and lying and cheating and whatnot. But number two, when they have subjects look at the photos of the people, of targets in the pictures, they can actually predict how aggressive they are or and whatnot, and what it seems like they are cueing into, even though they're not able to tell us this, is the ratio of the face. Namely, the beefier, wider faces, those guys are more likely to be more aggressive and lie and cheat and all this sort of stuff. But and they're looking at the width of their face, even though when they're making these predictions, they really don't know why they think they're making that prediction.
And you speculate, and I would think too, that the width of the face is probably linked to testosterone level, and you know, as far as why wider faced men rather than slimmer faced men were deemed more aggressive and actually shown to be. And why you said here that the men with slim faces not only don't seem to be as aggressive, they're more likely to die from contact violence than the wide-faced men. So if you're, you know, there are two dark alleys, and one has a skinny-faced guy and one has a wide-faced guy, I mean, there's skinny-faced men can be killers too, but I would bet, you know, if I had to choose just on that, I would take the one with the skinny-faced guy and hope that he would just ask me for directions and not knife me.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, a couple of interesting studies. I mean, it sounds weird, but, I mean, if you're playing the law of averages, that would be right. Obviously, you know, on a case-by-case basis, we always have to be careful, but a couple interesting studies. So in one I write in the book that researchers measured the width-to-height ratios of hundreds of skulls found across the United States, with over 200 coming from murdered people. And then for those skulls belonging to victims of homicide, the researchers coded the cause of death as either contact violence or quote-unquote other. And contact violence meant, you know, that there was evidence that the victims had been strangled, stabbed, or beaten to death, whereas the other category indicated the victim had, you know, endured a gunshot or was poisoned, or that the researchers didn't know the cause of death. It turns out the narrow-faced men were significantly more likely to die from the contact violence than the wide-faced men. And then this other study is really fascinating, and this kind of blows my mind away, is investigators asked participants to roll a pair of dice to determine how many times they'd be entered into a lottery to win a $50 gift card, and wide-faced men were about 9 times more likely than slim-faced men to overstate their results, you know, basically cheat, you know, saying they rolled a higher number than they actually did. So, I mean, 9 times, that's a pretty big difference. And they see this in the lab. And, you know, I'd love to know, like, what is this in real life? But, you know, obviously we can't quite study cheating in such a nice, clean way in the real life. But I'd be willing to bet it does map on in real life to some degree. And, again, we always got to do case-by-case studies. I mean, we all know plenty of wide-faced, beefy-faced men who are, you know, complete teddy bears who are, you know, very calm and non-aggressive. I don't know
right.
That though.
Right. But the researchers in that study, the $50 gift card study, did say that they found that wide-faced men perceive themselves as powerful, and that contributed to their unethical behavior. So I love what they said. Our findings suggest that some men are simply predisposed to act unethically in order to achieve their goals. And again, you give these caveats, you know, people are individuals and we can't look at every person that way. But there are many of these studies where people, as you say, it's not so much does this always play out, but that so many people predict certain things about certain looks. And one of these things you write about is a person with a baby face, a man who has a baby face, like Zac Efron or Justin Bieber, and Babe Ruth was another example that you give. What do they predict about the baby-faced man?
Yeah, and well, if you don't mind, can I just go back to one point
that?
Go ahead. The width of the size. This is really. I've been thinking more about this lately. After I wrote the book, actually, I wish I would have written more about this in the book, but it has an interesting sort of philosophical implication, right? Is that if the width of a man's face is driven by testosterone, and the testosterone is somewhat or probably even largely driven by sort of biological factors, then it has implications for our ethical behavior and somewhat whether we're predisposed to act ethically. And so it's that quote that you read out of my book that I was quoting, a researcher said, our findings suggest that some men are simply predisposed to act unethically. I mean, that's a pretty powerful finding if you think about it that way, right? That some men are just probably born more likely to lie. Now, obviously, I don't think we can use biology as an excuse or, you know, there's culpability and whatnot to it, but the fact that there are some men predisposed to be like that perhaps is a pretty provocative and, you know, something that we should really ponder, really.
Absolutely. And actually, I mean, I think you can say there are some people, men and a few women, because women don't have as much testosterone. And it seems that may drive the fighting and the aggressiveness, but that who are just born bar fighters. And I've been looking at dietary research. I just interviewed Jeff Volek, who's a really great dietary researcher I've had in the show, about testosterone levels and how a skinny guy can raise his because you need testosterone to put on muscle. You know, and he, you know, talked about eating fat And I mean, there are things you can do. So you could also probably, if you're a guy who's a big bar fighter, it might be possible to experiment to eat the opposite of what I'm going to suggest in that column. I haven't researched that, but to look at what decreases testosterone and maybe eat more that way and see if it maybe makes you feel a little less aggressive. And again, it's hard to know for sure because it's hard to measure your own behavior, especially if you're not doing it in any scientific randomized way. But it might be a thought for somebody who has problems in that area.
Right. I agree. You asked about baby faces, just to get back to that. So if you ask people, when researchers ask people, you know, what do you think about baby face people? What do they, you know, how do they strike you? And people see them as more sort of physically weak and but warm and honest and kind of submissive. And it's this idea, researchers think, that people are kind of overgeneralizing sort of the features of a baby to these people, right? So a lot of these baby-faced people, the people are reporting, are somewhat similar to babies in terms of some of their traits, you know, in terms of being warm and honest but submissive and weak and whatnot. And there's mixed findings on that. I mean, we don't, if there is anything there, truth to that, it's probably not very, you know, it's not strong. It's not a big effect size or whatnot. But what is interesting is that women who have baby faces are overly, quote unquote, overly represented, meaning disproportionately represented in helping professions such as nursing and teaching and that sort of stuff. But another interesting thing about baby faces is that in the court of law, baby-faced people are let off more easily. You know, they're not fined as much by judges, and especially if they're in court against a sort of a dominant, mature-looking face person. These characteristics, such as honesty and these childlike qualities, are kind of extended to that person in the court of law. And they're not, you know, they're kind of let off more easily. So I talk about a study where, you know, Boston judges found the vast majority of the most mature-faced men, about 92% guilty, whereas those deemed less, were they deemed less than about half, like 45% of the most baby-faced defendants guilty. So, you know, these judges were kind of discriminating, quote unquote, against people based on their baby face versus maturity of their faces, even though, of course, these judges never even, I'm sure, contemplated that.
Right. And it's so important if we recognize our biases. And we talked about this on the Shabri show about, you know, that eyewitness accounts are so unreliable. If we recognize that, maybe we can be more fair. And judges, you also say they ordered more mature-faced culprits to pay plaintiffs significantly more money, but only if the plaintiff had a baby face. And so what this tells me, as somebody who lives in Los Angeles, is that if you're going to court and you look really mature, get a really good makeup artist if you can.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds maybe silly, but it is possible by doing things with little, even if you're a man and you don't want to look like you're wearing makeup, to sort of widen and whiten the eye with just neutral makeup. And I wanted to add, too, that these features, these baby face features in women, they talk about this a lot in the ed psych literature. They're called neotenous features, and they're very attractive. These are women who are very attracted to men with the large eyes and rounded faces and small chin. And so this is just this very this look, I guess, that captivates many of us in both men and women.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's no surprise that, you know, Mickey Mouse and other, you know, wildly popular cartoon characters have some of these same features. We're drawn to them. You know, there's probably a biological propensity for liking them and wanting to care for them and thinking they're cute and all this good stuff.
Yeah, that explains all those black velvet paintings, the big eyes that I grew up with. We're going to move on to deception, but this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking tonight with psychologist Dr. Matthew Hertenstein, and his very interesting book is The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are. So I know this research really well on deception. You do really well with it, which means that you talk about all the myths. And there's a great quote starting your chapter on deception from Carolyn Wells, who's an author and a poet, and it's actions lie louder than words. Do you have any comment on that quote?
Well, I mean, I think that's the whole, that's the core of the chapter. That's the core of why people are interested in deception, is because words are so easy for people to control. I can stop talking. I can change my words. I can manipulate them. So can you and everybody else. But actions and what we show on our faces and our gestures, the way we walk, even, you know, the emotional envelope with which we say words, is much more difficult to control. And so that's why researchers have been so interested over the years to try to figure out, well, what are the tells? What are the cues to deception? In my book, The Tell, I go over several of those cues, but I also give a lot of caveats, which I'm sure you'll ask me about.
Oh, no, we'll get to those. And so, but I want to talk about, you know, you talk about that we're really bad lie detectors, and we think that we're really good, but you talk about why we're such bad lie detectors. And I want to give three reasons. I want to have you comment on them. The first you say is that ignorance is bliss. We just don't want to know. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, the point in fact in life is, you know, people lie all the time. So if you you know, read studies by Bella DiPaolo and others, she and others find that people lie on average about once or twice a day, depending on who you are. So, I mean, don't kid yourself. every listener out there, all of us, we lie every single day. The vast majority of us do, unless you're a very, very special person. Now, that being said, of course, what's that?
I said, or a jerk, because if you're there, I just finished my book that's coming out in June, and I wrote about honesty is the best policy, except when lying your ass off is a better policy. And I'm talking about being kind to people in that chapter because, you know, there are people who they use honesty like a hammer, and I think that that's wrong. You shouldn't always tell the truth. But, you know, you're talking about these lies that just, I mean, there's so many lies that fly by us. And so, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop you there, but continue on the tangent and the trajectory you're on about ignorance being bliss. And then you talk about also how the signal to noise ratio is low.
Right. So we all lie, which means we're all the targets of lies. And when people lie to us, it's just easier. I think most of us would agree, sometimes at least, to just ignore things, right? If we suspect a lie, it's not worth the trouble sometimes to delve deeply into if somebody is lying or not, because if you're wrong, that can cause a lot of trouble and whatnot. Sometimes we just let things slide by because it's just life is easier that way. Another reason, which you brought up that I talk about in the book, is I say the signal to noise ratio is low, meaning, you know, there's a lot of things going on when somebody's telling us something, and the little clues, the tells that do reveal deceit are very subtle, and they are taking place amongst a cacophony, a whole group of other behaviors. And so these little, you know, vocal intonations, posture, head nods, fidgeting, eye contact, you know, speaking rate, leg movements, all of this stuff, all of these are so subtle, and so that noise, signal to noise ratio is low. And that makes it really, really tough to detect lies. A few other things, though, is, you know, I talk in the book is, you know, it's your parents' fault, you know. point in fact, most parents lie to their kids, right? And so not only are we setting an example for them, you know, in bad for good or for bad, but, you know, we're trying not to have them spot the trickery, right? We're teaching them, you know, all this sort of stuff. And they seem somewhat innocuous, but we're, you know, paradoxically, we might hinder our kids' abilities to even catch us lying. So, there's signal or noise ratios, there's evolutionary reasons why it might not have been, adaptive to be very good at detecting lies. And then the ultimate reason, which I think is totally true, is, you know, we don't receive feedback most of the time when it comes to lying, right? We don't know for sure. And if we don't get that feedback, then it's hard to teach the system and teach our body, teach our perceptual system to know if somebody's lying. So it's a tough go for people to tell lies. And some people think they're very confident, but like I said at the outset of our conversation, Amy, I mean, who knows? You know, confidence does not map on to accuracy.
Right. I've done a show on that recently. And actually, and you make the point, which is correct, that even trained experts have a hard time to know whether people are lying. It's very complex. We'll get into some of the clues. But I wanted to, when you talked about the signal-to-noise ratio being low, that these clues are very subtle, you say that when questioned by the police about a murder, a suspected liar and an honest person may give off similar signals of nervousness. And so those, all those little quote-unquote tells, like averting somebody's gaze, biting your lip, fidgeting, tapping their foot, or the thing I gave and the example I gave at the beginning of the show, touching your nose, scratching your nose, those are not really predictors of lying. So tell us what cues we should use to detect lies. You talk about two kinds.
Yeah, so I talk about thinking clues or thinking cues. And like cognitive cues and emotional cues, and both of these, you know, like thinking cues have to do with us like processing information, you know, trying to make sure that we don't mess up or and whatnot. And then the emotional cues are sort of like the signs of emotion that sort of leak out of us, for example, when we are telling cues. And so these cues end up being, there's a variety of them that we can look at. And I don't know if it would be interesting enough to go through every single one of them, but I'll touch on a few of them. And one of the ones that's been, is received a lot of attention, sometimes, you know, you got to be careful with this, is micro expressions. And so micro expressions are expressions that sort of flash on our face very quickly, split second, snap of the fingers, expressions that people have sometimes when they lie, and that are barely perceptible to most people, although you can train yourself with some training programs out there to be able to pick up on them. And when you see micro expressions, it can be a cue to tip you off that it might be a red flag to that somebody is lying. So, for example, if somebody's lying that they didn't steal the money or something like that, but they're scared of getting caught, you might see a fear face kind of come over themselves very, very fast. I'm talking like 1/20th of a second. And that would constitute a micro expression. But, you know, that cue along with some others, the one thing I will say is you have to really look at this as a constellation of cues. I would never want to, you know, ever accuse anybody of lying just because you see one thing. You have to see, you know, a lot of cues usually that people leave in, you know, like a wake of, you know, a path. And then that might be an opportunity to ask more questions. And I don't think anything is – this isn't such a perfect science that you can, you know, nail somebody with a lie or something like that.
Well, I want to get into cognitive load because on micro expressions, I really have a problem. This is Paul Ekman's research, and there's been criticism of some of his work in a recent study that said only 21% of the people in, you know, experience these and only in part of their face. And they're very hard to spot. And in fact, Ekman, there's been a huge, I don't know if it was like $1 billion, some huge amount of money. The TSA, which I really hate for violating our Fourth Amendment rights every time we want to see grandma. They hired Ekman, and he saw a guy and he thought, oh, he's a terrorist. The guy was sad because he was going to his brother's funeral. And so what I like in your book that you talk about as a way to, for ordinary people to spot this, because an expression that flies across your face so fast it can barely be seen, I think even for experts, obviously, since Ekman has failed, isn't that great. But you talk about how there's this extra mental effort that goes on when you're fabricating a story so that they hesitate and they're trying to think. You see that somebody's maybe trying to put something together, you know, when they, this story that they're coming up with, and it may come off more distant or removed because you talk about this cognitive load. They have to work very hard to invent the stuff. So it's not the same as telling a story that you remember.
Yeah, so the cognitive load is interesting because it's one of these things where we're not, especially for big lies, and that's the other thing, too, that we have to differentiate is between, you know, the little lies we might tell in life, which probably don't take too much cognitive load. So if my wife asks me, do I look good in this dress that I just bought? And I say, yes, that looks beautiful, honey. You know, even though I might not think that necessarily, but, you know, that's one of those little white lies that we tell to make people feel good, not hurt their feelings, especially if you're just going off for the date. You don't want to start it off, you know, on a bad footing or whatever. I mean, that would take very little cognitive load for me to tell that lie. But if I were to ask somebody who, you know, a bank teller, if they just stole $200 out of the drawer, and they had to concoct a story to explain why there is $200 missing and why it wasn't them, and they had to think of somebody else, that's going to induce and result in a lot of cognitive load. Like you said, they're going to have to think of a story that's going to have to hang together. It's going to have to be consistent. It's going to have to make sense on a certain timeline and whatnot. And these, you know, result in sort of hesitations a lot of times. Probably an increase in their sympathetic nervous system, so you're going to get, like, pupil dilation. So they'll result in some cues, but it's really just the cognitive work that's going on underneath, you know, the hood, so to speak, that person's not even necessarily feeling it at a perceptual level. But, you know, ultimately it has to take place because cognitively it takes a lot of work to lie and come up with an elaborate story.
Yeah, I think that that's the best way, but really it is very hard to see if somebody's lying. And I think that I love how you're honest about that, because I think that people need to really feel that they need to look for supporting evidence. You talk about look for a constellation of cues, and I think that the constellation has to include other things than just the person's story. And it helps to try to look for cues that somebody is honest early on. If you can, you know, and again, they may be deceptive in showing honesty, quote unquote honesty, but it's better to try to hire ethical people than to figure out if they're lying later, if it's somebody who's your employee.
Exactly. And if you do suspect somebody, let's say that they are leaving a constellation of cues, you know, in their path and whatnot, even then, you know, I would be really hesitant to, you know, call somebody out. But I think that's an opportunity to ask more questions. If you see, you know, in their story and you see some cues around a certain part of the story that they're telling, I think that's where you say, well, okay, let's back up and talk a little bit more about that. And then you go a little deeper, a little deeper, a little deeper into it. And that's where you can learn more information and find some hard evidence of inconsistencies of things that they actually say. So I think, you know, we just, like you said, and like I say in the book, we have to be careful of this, and most of us are not very good at it. And people are overconfident sometimes, especially if they read the academic literature. I even have to watch this myself. You know, I mean, I know all these cues. You know all these cues after reading the chapter. But, you know, you still have to have some humility about your capacities, and not to think that, you know, you're capable of finding out anybody who's a Pinocchio around you.
Right. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with psychologist Dr. Matthew Hertenstein, and his book is The Tell, The Little Cues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are. I loved your chapter on the power of enthusiasm. Most of my friends are either writers or professors. And so you talk about this thing that is the bane of most professors' existence, even if they're popular, and it's rate my professor. And students think that they're really good and perceptive at judging the quality of their teachers. But you wrote about this incredible study a guy did. This is this behavioral scientist, Stephen Cecchi at Cornell. So tell us about that. He wanted to test and did this controlled study about whether students would judge him as a better professor teaching one way or another. And I'll let you explain.
Yeah, so it's this great study, and, you know, he was interested in, as are a lot of faculty members, about student evaluation. So if you're the listener was a college student, at the end of every class, most universities had them fill out an evaluation about the professor, asking them, you know, how much did you learn, was an instructor organized, were they accessible, and whatnot. And these evaluations have pretty big consequences for those faculty members, depending on the type of institution that they're at. People get, you know, fired, you know, they don't get tenure for, you know, if they're a teaching-oriented institution, if they get bad ratings, for example. So these evaluations make a big difference in some professors' lives. And so this guy at Cornell had been teaching a course in developmental psychology for probably like 2 decades or something like that. And, you know, so he's very well rehearsed at teaching this course. And so he taught this course. And then Cornell had, during January, I assume, sometime between the first semester and second semester, he took a presentation course. And so this course didn't have anything to do with content, but it had everything to do with how you present the material in an enthusiastic manner and engaging the students, right? So he took this presentation, and he said, well, I think I'll teach the course again. I'll use the exact same, you know, overhead, the exact same textbook, the exact same jokes, the exact same everything in the spring semester as he did the fall semester. And, of course, he confirmed all of this with, you know, coders who were naive to what he was doing. And, in fact, everything was identical. And so the only thing he changed was his presentation style. And I love this study because it's just a really, really elegant pre-test, post-test thing going on. And he found when he asked these students at the end of the semester to fill out the evaluations that the students claimed that they learned more in the spring course, the Mr. Enthusiastic style version of him. They learned more. They had the students reported that the faculty member had there were clear goals. The grading was more fair. They even liked the textbook more in the second semester in the spring versus the first semester, even though, of course, the textbook had nothing to do with the presentation. So, and of course, they liked the instructor more, and they thought he was more organized and accessible and knowledgeable and everything else. So the point of the study, and I talk about this in the book, is I question sometimes the validity of those evaluations, because if it can be influenced that massively by how enthusiastic a person is, do the students really understand, you know, sort of the quality of the instructor, or is it really just hand waving? There might be something about being both, right? I mean, maybe hand waving enthusiastic instructors really are better. But when you looked at the exams, this is an important point. When you looked at the exams in the spring semester, they were basically virtually identical. They were no better. They didn't learn more in the spring semester. So even though they liked everything a lot more, they didn't learn more in the spring.
But you make this point about what is called the expressivity halo. And this is just something for people to know, that people perceive others who are expressive and animated to be warmer and more socially more sociable and dominant and motivated and even interpersonally skilled than people who are less expressive. So for somebody who needs to maybe compete with somebody who's pretty equal with them in skills, I think that that's something to look at to try to come off more enthusiastic. And I naturally come off like this, but some people are more reserved, and that's maybe something to try, but where you don't come off fake, but you you know, you really are going to help yourself if you can do that. Be a little more expressive. Maybe take a course like this guy Chechi did to be more expressive, to maybe just go from a 1 to a 3 and maybe on a 1 to a 9.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really social psychologists study this. It's a really, really powerful effect, probably even more powerful than what researchers sometimes call the attractiveness halo. So, you know, people who are physically attractive, you know, it has this halo effect where they also think that they're smarter, and they also think that, you know, they have all these other positive attributes, which don't necessarily map onto reality, of course, but nonetheless, attractive people enjoy all the benefits of that halo. And in the same way, you know, there's the expressivity halo, like I talk about in the book, that people who are expressive enjoy all these other advantages. People assume all these good things about them just because they are expressive. And so, yeah, I mean, it does reap, provide benefits. And I think people can take advantage of that if they want to. Although, you know, I'm not one of these people either to say, well, you know, expressivity and outgoingness and extroversion is the end all be all. I mean, there's definitely a place in the world for, you know, quiet wallflower, you know, pensive people who are just sitting there in the corner and thinking. But I definitely do think it behooves people to know that that's how they're perceived differently versus, you know, the very, very expressive person.
No, absolutely. I think it's good to know this stuff because then you can at least make a choice. We are about out of time. So I just would like to know, do you have any final words of wisdom to leave us with?
Yeah, well, you know, in the book I talk about the fact, and I do believe this, is perceive the tell my book to be a quote-unquote self-help book. You know, like if you see, you know, behavior X, Y, and Z, then it means A, B, and C or something like that. I don't see that. But what I do see when people read the tell, the little clues that reveal the big truths about who we are, is that it helps us just kind of appreciate the interactions we have with people a little bit more, to be kind of more of a sophisticated observer. It's kind of like drinking wine and really understanding the wine and perceiving the wine in terms of taste much more sophisticated than, you know, just downing the glass. So, yeah, I mean, the tell is all about perceiving and social interactions in a much more sophisticated way.
Yeah, and again, I'll quote your Sherlock Holmes quote. I've trained myself to notice what I see. Thank you. This has been so great. I've been talking with Dr. Matthew Hertenstein. His book is The Tell, the little clues that reveal big truths about who we are. Thank you so much. Very, very interesting show.
Thank you very much, Amy. I appreciate it.